From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleinman, and this is Good Food. Today on the show, we are all dressed up for Halloween. Vincent Price is here in spirit. And cannibalism. Does it still exist? I've got all the gory details. How to eat like the French, plus everything you ever wanted to know about scallops. But first, let's see what's fresh and in season this final week of October at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're happy to see Alain Giraud at the market here today, and he has been very busy getting together his new restaurant up in Pacific Palisades. The restaurant will be called Maison Giraud, and Alain was most recently seen at Anisette Brasserie right here in Santa Monica. And now, Alain, we all cannot wait for your new place to open. Tell us what it is, what the concept is, and when you think you're going to be open for us.
Okay, perfect. Good morning. It's nice to be at the market. It's a good sign. When you see me back at the market, it means you're very close to be open. It was a long way. We found a beautiful location in Pacific Palisades. There's 1032 Swarthmore. It's in the center of the village. You asked me the question. We found it's a restaurant with a French bakery inside. Mm. Okay, because people try to say it's a French restaurant. I'm not totally sure it's a French restaurant. It's a restaurant with no brasserie, no bistro, just a restaurant. And as it's supposed to be, I guess, it's based on the ingredient of the season, of the market. And I will try to really cook whatever I found on the season, you know, simple. And having a French bakery inside, we make the place part of the community, I guess. By that, I mean we'll be opening 7 days a week, breakfast very early, like 7:30 in the morning, and all day. In lunch after, in afternoon, we do the goûter, what nobody knows what it is. It's a French snack. It's what you do after, you know, after sport or before sport, after class.
It's what the English do at tea time.
Yeah, tea time. We do a French tea. We be chocolate and pain au chocolat. After the goûter, we do the dinner. Mm-hmm. Dinner, and more important, we do a to-go all day. And the to-go is a big part of the life in the Palisade. Mm-hmm. That is one day you feel relaxed at home. You just call us and you pick up a nice roast chicken, some fingerling potato from Alex, some lemon tart from Peter from the market, so it'd be perfect.
Sounds so good. So you will be inspired to cook your favorite dishes. It'll be not necessarily the same thing, but you will do certain things every day, and of course...
We keep, I'm planning to put a French soup au pistou, what is really a vegetable soup, a nice big dice where the flavor are very clear, and you add some fresh beans inside and a nice... We do a small twist, but we don't want to be reinventing the food. We just want a nice, earthy, healthy food. Plus, the best thing, after suffering in Santa Monica, I'm sorry about the parking issue, you know that. We have a lot of street parking, mostly free, plus a free parking in the back of 180 parking. Yes, so we can do 180 customer, yes.
Oh, that sounds so good. Now, the big question, when will you be open?
I don't understand the question. Can you repeat? No, I mean, I heard this question for the last 3 months.
I know.
It was a part of, the challenge to open a new place, the permit change almost daily and all the things. Yeah. We are so close now. We are finishing our corrections. Mm-hmm. And I would say 1-2 weeks, you'll be ready. I mean, I said that months ago, so I'm a little bit careful, but... Okay. We need to open. You know, I'll be a bump in the middle of the market soon, so I need to open ASAP.
We're so excited, Alain. And it's so great to see you here, as always, with your signature sweater, your shopping bag. Yeah. And we're very excited. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And the farmer's market are part of my life. I was raised in a farmhouse, and I love the market. So I think cooking starts in the morning here with beautiful ladies. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. That was Alain Giraud, and we are so excited. He's going to be opening Maison Giraud up in the Palisades. And plenty of parking. This is the time of year when Adams Olive Ranch brings in their fresh cured olives. And Alex is here today at the Wednesday Market. He's been working with Adams Olives for years. And these fresh olives, Alex, these are the ones that they're still green. It's the first pick. And now you have a special way, in addition to all your preserved olives, that these come off very fresh. Tell us what the process is and how long you're going to have them.
Filtered water, sea salt. And we not give them to fermenting. So basically they stay for like 1 week to 10 days, not longer. But you have to keep them only in the refrigerator. They can go be like 3 to 4 months. and they're not fermenting, they don't have any acid or something.
And the fresh olives, we call it fresh cured, it's the first pick, and so you don't wait till the olives turn red or black, you pick the green olives.
The green, the first pick when it's harvest comes. First we start to do the green ripes, and after in November we start to press manzanilla olive oil.
And what varieties are the green cured, all the varieties?
The variety basically manzanilla and some mission.
Okay, and they are they all different sizes? Like I noticed one looked like a jumbo, one looked like a small, all different sizes?
Basically, this year it came a little bit bigger size of fruit, but they like regular. They're not small one like manzanilla usually comes small. They're a little bit bigger size.
Okay, Alex, well, these are delicious. You said you might have them all the way through Thanksgiving?
Yeah, we're going to try to do our best.
Okay, and I really recommend people try these. It's just this buttery, delicious. You can just eat them with a spoon. They are fabulous. So excited. Thank you, Alex.
They like candy.
That was Alex, who works with Adams Olive Ranch. Adams is a fifth-generation olive farmer who comes down from Northern California, and these fresh, he calls them the green ripes. These are the fresh-cured, only salt and water. You keep them in the refrigerator, but they don't last because you're going to eat them all. Coming up this November 3rd is our last library panel of the year. This one is going to be called Have a Do-It-Yourself Holiday. We're going to have two farmers, one from Skyline Flower Growers and Cheryl Gaines from It Began in the Garden, who are going to tell us how to make beautiful flower arrangements and how to use flowers, dried flowers, and other things for the holidays. We're also going to have Chef Mark Gold from Eva and Chef Clemence Gossett from the Gourmandise School of Sweets and Savories to share some holiday baking and cooking ideas for us. That's this coming Thursday, November 3rd at the Santa Monica Main Library. It'll be a speaker panel followed, as always, with treats prepared by the chef for all in attendance. It's free and open to the public, and we sure hope we see you there. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Halloween is just around the corner, and rather than the usual candies and confections, I'm celebrating with scary movies.
And I've rented the house on Haunted Hill tonight so that my wife can give a party. A haunted house party. She's so amusing. There'll be food and drink and ghosts. And perhaps even a few murders. You're all invited.
Remember that voice? It's the voice of Vincent Price, the famous horror film actor. Depending on your age, you may remember him from The House of Wax or from Edward Scissorhands. But I remember him as a charming gourmand and cookbook author. His daughter, Victoria Price, joins me today to talk about her dad's great passion for food and cooking.
Well, I think we should begin with the fact that he was somebody who just plain loved to eat. And he got that love of food from growing up in St. Louis, I really believe, which was a place that had a lot of great opportunities to eat around the world without leaving home, German cuisine, Italian cuisine. And his mother was a wonderful cook, apparently, and a great fan of the potluck in particular, reusing things in creative ways. And so he loved to eat and had the good fortune, of course, through his career to travel the world and eat a tremendous amount. And because my father could charm pretty much anyone, he would go into restaurants and love something and charm the chefs out of the recipes. And through that process, he became a wonderful cook because he went home and recreated the recipes for his friends. So growing up with him eating that way, I certainly did not eat like most of the other kids because we were eating very adventurously from a very young age.
And were you cooking next to him side by side in the kitchen?
You know, it's a good question. My dad's favorite meal of the day was breakfast. And he traveled quite a bit, so he was out of town a lot. But when he was home, I would get to make breakfast with him on Saturday mornings. And that was an incredible highlight. He taught me how to make pancakes. He taught me how to make popovers. But other than that, I was sort of born in the era where kids were better seen from a distance. So dinner parties were a big deal in our home, and my mother went to great lengths to create these very elaborate dinner parties. Like, for example, one time she had a walk-in kiln, and she literally gold-plated the set of dishes, especially for this dinner party. But I was not at many of those dinner parties. So I did not cook much past breakfast with my dad.
The cookbook that he wrote was so, it was really an incredible book that really showcased the breadth of his knowledge and his passion. How did it come about?
I always like to say that my parents didn't start the project because they were great cooks. They were great collectors of experience. And my mother was a designer. My father was an art collector. So wherever they went, they were taking in the world in every way they could. My mother would sometimes bring back an entire set of dishes from a particular plate or linen so that she could be reminded of that experience. They were people who really absorbed where they went, and eating was a part of that, really understanding the culture. And so the cookbook really came about because they wanted to share what they had been sharing with their friends, the experience of eating at these wonderful places, but with a larger public. And my dad was at the time selling art through Sears Roebuck. People don't really know about this, but he bought all the art for Sears Roebuck. And I'm talking Picassos and Vuillards and Whistlers and a lot of emerging artists as well. And he sold them through Sears. It was called the Vincent Price Collection. And you could buy a Picasso, really literally, on your Sears credit card for $5 a month with a money-back guarantee. And this put him into a whole different category in terms of being a purveyor of the arts and sort of a cultural ambassador. And it was through Sears that the cookbook came about, this idea of sharing their experience. And my mother designed the whole book. So she was really about having people understand the experience visually. And then my dad was about having them understand it culinarily.
Wow, what a story. What is one of your favorite spreads in the book?
Well, I think the two that really stick with me were favorite things from my childhood. One of my favorite things to do was to take the Super Chief from downtown L.A. to Santa Fe, New Mexico. And you would wake up in the morning just outside of Flagstaff, and that's when train travel was just so wonderful. You would be there with the white linen tablecloths and the little silver vase with the rose and the real cutlery, and they had the most delicious French toast, and they included that recipe in the cookbook. So I love that one. I love also the fact that they included Dodger Stadium hot dogs in there. And it's one of my favorite pictures from the cookbook of my parents and my godparents, Martha and Cleveland Amory, sharing a hot dog at the Dodger game. And I think the one that I've enjoyed cooking the most is the chicken curry. It's very elaborate chicken curry, and I think the recipe's from Pierre in New York.
Isn't that fabulous? Victoria, thank you so much for giving us this extra peek at the marvelous view of life and food that your dad had.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It was a great way to grow up.
I'll bet. That was Victoria Price, daughter of the famous Vincent. Vincent and Mary's cookbook, A Treasury of Great Recipes, is sadly out of print, but that isn't to say it's been forgotten. Alina Shatkin, food writer for the LA Weekly and frequent contributor to Good Food, recently hosted a Vincentennial dinner party featuring dishes from the cookbook in honor of the centennial of Vincent's birth. Good Food producer Laurel Garcia attended the potluck. She asked Alina to describe the importance of Vincent's cookbook.
It's got this gorgeous puffy cover, kind of like, a really nice high school yearbook. It's got gilt-edged pages. It's almost 500 pages long, and it collects all sorts of amazing recipes. It was published in 1966 and reprinted a few times. And at the time, it was fairly popular. And it had a lot of great recipes, like the Sauerbraten mit Kartoffelklaas, which is something I probably mispronounced, but it basically means pot roast with potato dumplings. It was a famous dish at Luchow's in New York City. They weren't snobs at all, even though they loved food. For example, one of the things that Vincent Price really talks up in the book is the hot dogs at Chavez Ravine, a.k.a. Dodger Stadium. So they liked food from all across the spectrum, from different restaurants, from different countries, from different cultures. Some of the recipes that they include in the book are things that they made at home. So we decided that what better way to honor Vincent Price, the Vincentennial, the year that he would have turned 100 were he alive, than by throwing a Vincent Price-themed dinner party. We put up the invitation on Facebook, and then we just asked people to volunteer for things. And when they were, when dishes were taken up, we said, sorry, somebody's already cooking that, pick something else. And so most of like the, you know, 20 or so dishes that we picked, people volunteered for. A few didn't get picked, but you know, it's okay. Broiled trout with cucumber salad we can do next year.
I'm David Frommé. I made sauerbraten with potato dumplings and stracciatelle. The sauerbraten is basically just a pickled pot roast, and the potato dumplings were supposed to be boiled, and I did boil them, and they turned into soup. So I decided they'd be better off fried, so we have some fried dumplings. It was a Vincent Price kicked my ass all day, so...
My name is Margot, and I made the chicken in pineapple. And when I asked for the recipe, I thought it was going to be chicken with pineapple baked into it. But in fact, you just hollow out the shell, and then you mix like heavy whipping cream, butter, chicken, mushrooms all together, and then put it back in the pineapple, and supposedly the flavor seeps in. But I wasn't really buying that, so I went ahead and put some pineapple juice in to get the pineapple-y flavor. And the recipe was designed to do an individual pineapples. And the quantities were basically to make one small pineapple. So I just kind of used my own judgment using the ingredients in the recipe and made a big pan of it. And then I put a little bit in a hollowed out pineapple for effect.
My name is Edwin Baker, and I made spumoni. It was unlike anything I've ever made before because it's basically just Marsala wine, egg yolks, and heavy cream with some sugar and almond extract. And then it's supposed to be topped with a candy chestnut, which I had a lot of trouble finding. So I ended up boiling some chestnuts in syrup for a very long time. And I'm hoping that that will make up for what it's missing.
The recipes are definitely sort of a relic in many ways. The first thing I noticed when we were cooking the recipes is that, in fact, many of them don't seem very detailed or very well planned. It seems like maybe they went to the chef at this restaurant and said, oh, how do you cook this? And the chef just knows how to cook it because he does it every day, but he doesn't actually think exactly how many tablespoons of this or how many cups of that. So a lot of it seems sort of guesstimated, and you kind of have to fudge some of these things.
Hi, my name is Jason Spiritos, and I made an Italian tipsy cake. Basically, it's a three-layered cake. He says that it was just regular cake, but it's definitely a pound cake soaked in rum, with vanilla custard and chocolate custard, chantilly cream top, and candied violets. It was very difficult because he writes everything in paragraphs, but he loosely gives you the amounts. And I'm a culinary grad, so when I'm reading this, none of it made sense to me. None of my training was even in any of these texts.
It really is a relic of that sort of mid-century American ideal of haute cuisine, which is to say continental, which is to say European.
So I'm Shauna Dawson, and I made the Colcannon, which is a British dish. And according to the cookbook, this was actually from Harrods, which I find intriguing because it's kind of Irish peasant food. So I will say this is the first and only time that I think I looked at the recipe at least 100 times while I was making it, even though it seemed really simple, because I was kind of baffled by the proportions and I couldn't believe that things were quite right and that I was really soaking scallions for an hour. But I was determined to follow the instructions, fearful it would be a little soupy, more than whipped potato-ish, also fearful of how that much butter to the tune of about a half a pound would really fold in to a scant 3 pounds of potatoes, but miraculously it is in there. I have admittedly been soaking up pools of butter with napkins discreetly that are forming in the corner.
There's a sauce that Vincent Price had in the cookbook called Supreme Sauce, and it was butter and cream and all this stuff. And I was like, why would you put this on when the same ingredients are already in the chicken and pineapple recipe? But I guess you have to have cream on top of cream.
I am Michelle Grant. I am the co-host for this lovely evening of the Vincentennial. And one of the dishes that I made was the Chichen Itza. And according to the Vincent and Mary Price cookbook, I used approximately a pound of butter for this wonderful meal.
My name is Drew Fansler, and I made the black pepper steak. And I believe I used one stick of butter for I believe it was 3 pounds of sirloin to make the steak au poivre. About half of that was used to sauté the steak on both sides, and then the rest was to mount the sauce.
I'm figuring that we used about 20 pounds of butter this evening. I'm not sure there was any dish that was prepared for this evening that did not, in some way or another, involve butter as one of the main ingredients. Butter, cream, and perhaps bacon seem to be the main ingredients in most of the dishes in this wonderful cookbook. And, you know, it's reminiscent of a time that, you know, in some ways, thankfully, we've left behind. And what's really great, I think, is that to take these kinds of dishes down the road and reinterpret them for a modern time. That's not necessarily about what this evening's been about, but certainly there's a lot of really wonderful inspiration that we've been able, I think that a lot of people have been able to find from this. I mean, nobody really thinks of vegetables in a ring mold any longer. And one of the best dishes that I've had this evening has been the green pea and artichoke ring mold. And it's ridiculous and oddly colored and delicious. Who knew?
I understand. It must have been terrifying. So many unexplainable things have happened here. There's something about the place. Your servants must have sensed it when they walked out on you. An apprehension of disaster.
How are you celebrating Halloween this year? Do you celebrate with sweets? Or maybe a fun costume? My favorite costumes are always food-related. Hot dog on a stick, anyone? Post some pictures of your favorite food-related costumes on Facebook. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. Coming up, it's Dinner with a Cannibal. That's next after this short break.
This is producer Jillian Ferguson. You can connect with other food lovers on Evan's Facebook page. Share photos, ask questions, and meet new friends. Search for Evan Kleiman on Facebook and click like.
Humans are omnivores. That means that sometimes in our history, we've even eaten each other. Carol Travis Hennikoff explores the historic and social context of cannibalism in her book, Dinner with a Cannibal. Carol, define cannibalism for me.
Cannibalism is the ingestion of any part or any anatomical part of one's own species.
And I understand that there are different types of cannibalism. Can you describe the various reasons why human beings would turn to cannibalism?
The most obvious and the one that probably gets other people to start a habit, if they do that, is starvation. That's survival. And you do it because you really are not going to survive without consuming the flesh that is there. Endocannibalism is when you eat of your dead, and that goes into funerary cannibalism. And then there's exocannibalism. That's revenge, war, ridding yourself of an enemy, terrorism, and so forth. Then there's iatric cannibalism, which is medicinal, which was practiced throughout all 500 years of the Inquisition in Europe. And autophagy is when you eat of yourself, whereas benign is when you are totally unaware of what you happen to be eating or just ate. Culinary sounds pretty gruesome, but culinary is simply dinner, no emotion or belief system connected with the act. And then there is religious that can be actual or simulated.
Is it generally practiced on adults or on infants?
The audience should know that we all come by this naturally because from one cell animals in your gut to chimpanzees, cannibalism is found. It's all, and we've even now proven that the dinosaurs did it. In the animal kingdom, it is usually against the young, is when a male lion comes and takes over pride and kills and devours nursing cubs, so the females will come back into estrus. In humans, infanticide has been rampant. This is going back a long ways now. There are so many tribes and peoples that went to war or actually went into enemy territory to both kill someone and to take him home for dinner. So amongst humans, historically, going back a long, long time, I'd say more adults have been consumed than infants.
Did cannibalism contribute to our development as a species?
I believe it did. My main field is paleoanthropology, and when we find sites of cannibalism, they have always eaten the brain, which is the most nutritious thing and very fatty, but also they always ate the organ meat, and there is no reason why it wouldn't. A grisly fact has been discovered in laboratories recently, and that is that when an animal eats of its own species, the stomach, which can usually digest almost anything, it still recognizes protein as being foreign to it. And so it takes a lot of enzymes and so forth to break it down. But when you eat of your own species, the gut actually digests it in a better manner, and you actually derive more sustenance from it.
The two most well-known instances of cannibalism in modern day are the Donner Party and the Chilean rugby team, whose plane crashed in the Andes in 1972. Is there any record of the psychological effects of these two groups from eating human flesh?
No, there's a lot of stuff. The Donner Party people, by the way, the Donner people, the Donner family, were the head leaders, and they had many animals, and they didn't practice cannibalism. They were not reduced to it. The different groups got separated by the snows, and it was the people who had fewer animals and were not bringing along excess oxen or horses that had to resort to eating their dead. And from what I've read, they had no remorse. They were embarrassed by what others said of how they had managed to live through the winter. And their main emotion was the grief of those who had died that they had to eat. As to the rugby team, those fellows all came out far more religious than they went in. They were all of quite wealthy families. They were all Catholic, and they came, you know, when you go through a disaster, it changes you, and we're weird. It usually changes us for the better. We become broader in ability to think and see and accept more things, and they actually said that when they realized that the only way they could possibly survive was to eat of their dead. Some likened it to the Last Supper, and they all came out, I would say, bigger emotionally and brain-wise than they went in. Who do you know who has ever been truly starving to death? Everything in your mind and body changes. Survival is supreme, and you're old brainstem, your old reptilian brainstem in there will absolutely encourage you to do anything to survive.
You know, it's interesting that the societal taboo can be overcome when we're starving. But what about creating the taboo when there was none?
Well, you know, taboos are simply something that one group of people or many groups of people decide is salacious and horrendous and often against their religion. I mean, a lot of people have gone around the world, walked into and made friends with cannibal tribes, and when they tell them you shouldn't do that, they look at them and say, why not? It's like somebody coming in to your Thanksgiving dinner and telling you that you can't eat that turkey. That's hellacious. You can't do that. Just think how silly you'd think that person was.
Carol, it is one of the most fascinating books I've ever read. Thank you so much for taking the time to spend with us this morning.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for the call.
Talking to Carol got me thinking. What was it that caused the evolution of Homo sapiens? Richard Wrangham, professor of anthropology and chair of biological anthropology at Harvard University, believes the answer is fire. His book, Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human, examines how cooking, even more than agriculture, eating meat, or the advent of tools, allowed for our evolution from Homo erectus to Homo sapien. Of course, we here at Good Food love that argument. Richard, is there a lot of skepticism about what you're proposing?
Oh, there's always some good academic challenges. And one of the big problems is that there are two kinds of approaches to understanding when fire was first controlled, which, of course, is what you need for cooking. And one approach is the classic one, which is from archaeology. And archaeologists find very little evidence of fire that goes back into the deep realms of human evolution. They find very little beyond about 400,000 years ago. And I'm a biologist, and I'm looking at the biological evidence, and the biological evidence from the fossils tells me that surely cooking must have begun about 1.9 million years ago. So there's a good sort of, well, people call it science friction, some good rubbing up of these ideas with each other.
Tell me what you see as a biologist that makes you believe that fire came into the lives of our predecessors so long ago.
Well, the story begins for me with the observation that humans are really not good at living purely on raw food. And we know this now because the evidence is that the average woman living on an urban raw food diet, eating sometimes blended, sometimes ground, raw foods that have been domesticated, cannot have a baby. And we say that because from surveys of urban raw foodists, you find that the average woman stops menstruating on such a diet. Well, the extraordinary thing about that is that's an incredibly high-quality raw diet. So what it means is that if you went into the wild and tried to live on raw foods, then many more than 50% of women would not be able to breed. And that means that we are a different kind of animal from all of the other animals. Every other animal breeds very well on raw food. We don't. And you can point to what it is about us that's different from other animals. And there are two things in particular. One is that we have relatively small guts, so that if you tot up the total volume or weight of our small intestine and our large intestine, what you find is that we have the smallest guts in relationship to our body size of any of the other non-human primates. And in a similar way, we have small teeth compared to all the primates. So these are both intimately concerned with processing our food, of course. And the reason we have small teeth is we have a diet of soft food because we cook. And the reason we have small guts is because we've adapted to get rid of those expensive bits of tissue that we don't need now that we eat very high-quality food that only needs a small gut. So then the question is, when did these two characteristics arise in humans? When did we get our small guts and our small teeth? Well, the small teeth are read out very easily from the fossil record, and the biggest drop in the size of the teeth happened just about 1.9 million years ago, around the time of the evolution of Homo erectus. And then to judge from the way in which the bones of the fossils changed from having flared ribs to narrow ribs and a wide pelvis to a narrow pelvis, these are signals of the breadth of the gut and the total volume of the gut. And people have long thought that it was about that time, as a consequence of seeing the way the fossils change, that our guts got small too.
Did you also start to see an increase in the size of the brain pan around that time?
Well, yes. It starts increasing just a little bit before then, possibly under the influence of increased meat eating. But during the last 1.9 million years, you've had a very steady increase in the cranial capacity, the amount of room inside our skulls, which is normally taken up completely by the brain, so that's a good way of measuring the size of the brain. And for that reason, people have long been mystified by what it is about our way of life that enabled us to have a big brain. And the answer seems to have something definitely to do with our diet, because the amount of energy that it takes to run a brain is critical. It's a lot. Something like every fifth to a quarter of all our calories we eat is devoted just to keeping our brains going. It's a very expensive tissue indeed. And all of the animals that have big brains have found some way to divert energy towards their brain. Well, the great thing about cooking is that it increases tremendously the amount of energy we get out of our food. So it suggests that cooking releases the constraints on how much energy we can direct to our brain. And the specific way in which it does that is that it enables us to have smaller guts.
So I want to think about this idea of smaller guts being a good thing a little further. Is it because once the food is cooked, then it's more easily digested and all the nutrients sort of move out then into the rest of the organism much more easily?
You have it exactly right. The effect of cooking is multiple, but one of the important effects is that it reduces the physical complexity of the structure of the food, so that if you take a piece of meat, for instance, then by the time you've cooked it, you have gelatinized, you've liquefied those white bits, the collagen, threads that hold the connective tissue that holds the meat together. And that means that it is easier for the stomach to take it apart, for the enzymes to get at the protein in the muscle. Now, whenever you reduce the complexity of the physical structure and the food is more easily digested, it takes a shorter time to be digested. And that means that you have a faster throughput of the food through the gut. So you don't need to have such a big gut to hold lots of food while it is slowly being processed in the case of our close relatives, the chimps and the gorillas.
What a fascinating book. We're so happy that we got to spend this time talking with you.
Well, thank you so much. Everybody should investigate this. It's such an extraordinary story.
That was Richard Wrangham, author of Catching Fire, How Cooking Makes Us Human. Up next, are Americans over-intellectualizing our food? Find out in 1 minute here on KCRW 89.9 and KCRW.com.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station. Search for KCRW in the podcast section of iTunes to find other programs like Bookworm, The Treatment, The Business, Unfictional, and DNA. And thanks for listening.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. It's time now for a visit from my pal, Jonathan Gold. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly, and he joins me here every week with a restaurant suggestion. This week, we're revisiting Roy Choi's brick-and-mortar restaurant, Chago.
The basic conceit here, if you can call it a conceit, is rice bowls. Sort of like the beef bowls that we all used to get at the drive-thru counter at 2 in the morning, except with Korean flavor and with kogi flavor.
So give me a few examples of some of the bowls.
Probably the marquee bowl is something they call the buttered kimchi chow.
Oh, God.
Which is buttered rice. There's tofu that's been cooked with chili. There's edamame. There's ganep, the Korean herb that's shredded and tossed around. There's garlic, there's tons of soy, there's pork rinds, and it's all in one bowl of happiness. It basically tastes like an entire 20-course Korean dinner condensed into one bowl.
But on top of buttery rice, which right. has to just, as they say, kick it up a notch.
Exactly. And there's also fried egg on top of that.
Of course. So you get that lovely, drippy fat just infused and coated.
Right.
Okay, so if we don't go for the marquee bowl.
There is something they call chubby pork belly, which is really nice, you know, braised and crisped off and coated with a gochujang, the really hot, sort of slightly smoky Korean chili paste. And it's one of the better pork belly preps in town, even if you don't have the bowl with the fried egg and the ang choy and the horseradish and the shallots and all the other stuff.
I mean, that's the thing about Roy that's pretty amazing, is he'll take a food that is just unbelievable, can stand up on its own in terms of flavor and how it's prepared, and then he makes it just one of a symphony of ingredients.
Yeah, with Roy's style, as it's evolving, too much is never enough. And sometimes it doesn't work, and he seems to be able to have it happening that way. So, for example, you would have a plate of, you know, charred asparagus, charred on the grill, and you'd put it off with a little olive oil and a little salt, and it would be a really delicious dish.
I made it last night for dinner.
I don't blame you.
And what would Roy have done with it?
Well, if the words blueberry habanero salsa mean anything to you, plus garlic, plus chilies, plus... I think there's cheese and bacon on it. It's a lot. And the asparagus comes through as asparagus, and you get the flavors of the char. You get that slightly sweet, slightly acrid, wonderful round asparagus and spring flavor, but you get a lot of other stuff too.
Yummy. Now, is it purely rice bowl at Chago?
They have a section of appetizers, which include, for example, that asparagus, something they call the $12 salad, which has spinach and goat cheese and pecans and pickles and cranberries and, you know, a $12 salad for $7, just like something you would get from Carl's Jr.
That's so great.
And they have meatballs and such. But they also have a list of specials which go in and out, which will include other things like grapefruit yogurt with smoked almonds or their version of chili fries that comes with sour cream and a bunch of Korean flavors going on top of it.
Now, they're only open at night right now.
They are only open at night from 6 until midnight or whenever they feel like closing.
Fantastic. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold of the LA Weekly about Chago on Overland between Palms and National. You can get the exact address by simply texting the words good food to the number 69866. That's good food to the number 69866. And don't forget that you can see all of Jonathan's restaurant suggestions on the Good Food Restaurant map, which lives on the Good Food blog. Here on Good Food, we talk a lot about the way we eat. Are we in danger of actually over-intellectualizing our food? Adam Gopnik thinks the answer may be yes. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker, and his latest book is The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. Don't you find it slightly ironic that a culture that is as puritanically rooted as ours has fallen sort of headfirst into this extreme sort of sybaritic obsession?
Well, you would think that on the surface, right? But what we've done and what I'm trying to suggest in this book that we've done is that we've taken our Puritanism and we've moved it into the arena of pleasure so that we eat in a puritanical way even when we're trying to have a good time very often. We obsess about where the zucchini came from. We obsess about, and sometimes properly so, the ethics of vegetarianism or localism, instead of trying to draw as much pleasure, as much humane pleasure as we can from the table. We place our old puritanical obsessions there, and that's one of the things that I'm arguing against in this book.
Yeah, I don't know. It's so odd to me that we come from all over the world, yet this puritanical place that we created is just informs so much of how we react to everything in this extremist way.
Well, we like to moralize. We're a moralizing people. We're hypocritical people, but we're a moralizing people. And so when Americans seem to have constitutionally, and for a very long time, a hard time taking pleasure in something for pleasure's sake. Instead, we always have to find a reason why the pleasure we're having is improving the planet or improving our lives. There's a chapter in this book where I talk about a week that my family and I spent, at my instigation, I should add, just eating locally. We ate nothing except food and animals that had been grown or raised in the five boroughs of New York City. And in part, it was a little joke about the cult of localism, which I'm sure you've run into, the localvore who will only eat from the 100-mile food shed. And there are a lot of kind of arguments against it, just from an ecological point of view, from a planetary point of view. But what I was trying to point out is that the best argument for it, the best argument to eat locally, is because it's fun. Because that way you have to address directly the people who grow your food, the butcher who slaughters your chicken. And by doing that, you come into direct contact with the sources of your pleasures and of your experiences. That's a good argument for eating locally. That's a good reason for eating locally. It puts a face on your food. A bad reason for eating locally is because it will make you a better person.
The French, you spent a lot of time in France.
Many years living there and still go back regularly.
So this period that you spent eating locally, did it remind you of what your life was like in France?
Not really, no. In France, you know, I did a lot of shopping at farmers' markets. The Marché Biologique was one of my favorite places. But the French, who have many faults, and one of their faults is that they're locked into, in many ways, very conservative ideas about their own table, which I also try and talk about. But with all their faults, one of the great blessings and virtues of French life is that they have a truly civilized attitude about food. And that is exactly that what goes on around the table matters as much, if not more, than what's on the table. That the life of food is the continuities of the ceremonies of the table more than it is some medicinal benefit you'll get from eating. You know, I start this whole book with a letter, very remarkable letter, written by a guy named Jacques Decoeur. I don't know if you got to read it, that was written in 1942, just as Decoeur, who was a resistor, was about to be executed by the Nazis. And instead of talking about God or life or the meaning of the world, he writes to his parents about the great meals that they had shared together. And he ends it saying, questions of food have taken on great importance. And what he meant by that exactly was not that questions of deliciousness or what you could see on cable television or who's the top chef had taken on great importance. What he meant was that as he reviewed his own very heroic life, the thing that lingered, the thing that remained for him, were the pleasures he had shared with other people, lovers and friends and family, across the table. That's the core, I think, of our experience of eating. That's what makes it worthwhile. And that's what the French tradition sustains and the American tradition endangers.
You are as fascinating talking to you in real life as you are on the page. Thank you so much, Adam.
Well, what a kind thing to say. Thank you so much. Pleasure talking.
That was writer Adam Gopnik. His latest book is The Table Comes First. I've got more good food coming up after this short break.
This is Jillian Ferguson, producer of Good Food. Keep up with us all week long on our blog. You'll find recipes, photos, cooking tips, and videos. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
Scallops. There's a lot more to them than just a cylindrical piece of protein on a plate. Karen Tammies, a native marine biologist who teaches and manages the shellfish hatchery at Roger Williams University. She and her mom have written an absolutely incredible book about more scallop information than you ever even knew was possible. How many edible varieties of scallops are they?
I believe that all of them are edible throughout the world, and there's probably 400 varieties, but only about 25 to 30 will make their way to our dishes.
How do they procreate?
Some of them have separate sexes, and some of them actually have both sexes, they're hermaphrodites within the shell. But they will start to ripen as the water temperature or food availability increases. And then they will broadcast spawn. In other words, one will sort of release the eggs, and the other ones around them on a shellfish bed will sense that. And then they will start releasing either sperm cells or eggs, depending on what sex they are. And the whole bed just just sort of just releases at once. And so those little tiny little eggs hopefully get fertilized, and they cast out into the waves and the currents and so forth and develop. Their life cycle takes between 7 to 21 days, depending on the variety of scallops. For some of the sea scallops, it can go longer than that, up to 40 days. And they're carried along in the currents as they develop.
And how old can they live to be?
Some of the oldest recording scallops, I think, are in the 20-year range for them. And that's if we didn't harvest them. We just sort of left them alone. And obviously, hopefully, a predator like a starfish didn't eat them. So they can live quite a full life. And some of the scallops are native New England Bay scallop, which is also marketed as the Nantucket Bay scallop, lives for about 36 months or 2.5 years.
And the ones that are most common for us, both sea and bay, how old are they usually when they're taken for food?
The bay scallop off of New England is harvested in the second year of its life. And the theory behind that, which sort of started the whole fisheries back in the 1800s, is if we didn't harvest them, they probably would die through the winter of old age. And so we wouldn't actually have a crop. So they harvest them in the fall of the second year. So that way they've already spawned and they're allowed to sort of procreate and give off the next generation. Now with sea scallops, it's been our New England sea scallop, which actually drives the entire economy globally and is landed mostly in New Bedford. Those scallops are now in a management scheme where they're probably managed at a 4 to 8 year year old class.
Now, do scallops have eyes?
Yes, they do. What's really unique about scallops and why I like to work with them, not only as a researcher, but especially when we have kid groups come through here and they have never seen a scallop before, is they can actually swim and they can also see. So when you have scallops in the tank, it's very entertaining to watch them sort of swim up. And then when you hold them in your hand, if you can get them to open, our bay scallops have about 42 blue eyes, and our sea scallop here on the East Coast has about 120 eyes, and it looks right back at you.
Now, scallop meat famously has this beautiful, mild, sweet taste. Where does that come from?
You know, the meat itself is the muscle is what we're eating. And the way the organism stores its energy is the sugary product, the glycogen of the muscle. So it's sort of a natural little package of sugar as we consume it. So it takes on that flavor from its surroundings and its environment and the food that it actually eats, a microscopic phytoplankton. And here in New England, if you catch a native bay scallop in the fall in your bushel basket and you shuck it right away, it's had all summer. That scallop is reproduced, and then it puts a lot of energy into storing up this sugary complex into its muscle so it can make it through the winter. So if you're out there at the bushel basket and you catch one of these and you shuck it open and you eat it right away in October or November, it's the sweetest candy. It's a wonderful little sugary product, and it's a natural storage product for the scallop.
So let's talk about what we find when we open up the shell. There's that adductor muscle that we eat.
Yep.
But then there's a lot of other parts that maybe are eaten more in other cultures besides ours.
Yes, that's for sure. Here in the U.S., we tend to only eat the adductor muscle. It's just the way our food system has been set up. And quite frankly, it's not a bad food system in a sense that when you when you bring a scallop out of the water, it cannot last out of the water like a clam or an oyster. And so it can be highly perishable. So I think what we probably started to do is shuck the meats at sea, shuck the animal at sea, bring only the meats to shore, and discard the rest of this innards. And in the innards, basically there's gills, that's what they use to filter. There's its stomach and so forth. But the thing that stands out the most that the Europeans eat that we don't is this large reproductive organ, also known as the coral. And because it is coral-colored when it's reproductively ripe. It's its plumpest, it takes on this coral color. And that's basically what people in Europe are eating, in other cultures, not just in Europe, but they'll find that they'll eat the coral attached with the adductor muscle on a plate. It may come to you that way.
Yeah, I've been lucky enough to have the coral a few times, actually.
I've never had it on a very large scallop.
Yeah, they're beautiful, beautiful. Now, what's the difference between sea scallops and bay scallops?
Well, without getting extremely technical and going through the classification system for scallops. I think the general rule of thumb is that the bay scallops are found in bays and estuaries, not far from a port, you know, up to maybe 30 to 50 feet or 100 feet deep, not very deep at all. And bay scallops can be found in these habitats throughout the world. But then when you start talking about sea scallops, people generally lump the sea scallop category into sort of a deep sea bivalve where you have to actually get into a larger vessel and maybe get out there, and they're in a deeper, colder water to some extent. Sometimes they're not. They're in a tropical area. But they have a range of habitats that goes into the deeper ocean rather than just being right in, close up in an embayment like Nantucket Harbor or so forth.
What causes the great difference in size in the way that they're marketed to us? Most of us, when we think of a bay scallop, we think of a very small piece of meat versus a sea scallop, which can be quite large.
Right. Well, that touches upon two things. Obviously, the biology of the scallop is different. So sometimes the bay scallops are just naturally smaller. They don't grow much bigger than those meats that you see. And the sea scallops have the ability to have a larger meat. But in terms of some of the bay scallops that are on the market, the consumer should be looking for in the fall, especially here in New England and Nantucket, bay scallop, and that's when the season is. Now, bay scallops can also come from other parts of the world, and China imports the same bay scallop that we have off our shores after farm raising it, and they grow it for only 1 year, and they do all the shucking and the processing and the freezing over in China, and they ship it back to us. So it's the same bay scallop, but it's extremely small. And a lot of the consumers that I've talked with always ask that question when we're out on our book tour. They ask, what are those really tiny scallops? They say bay scallops, but they should say Chinese bay scallops. So it's basically a bay scallop. It's only been grown for 1 year. So the meat is extremely small.
Karen, it's been so great talking with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
You can hear more of my fascinating conversation with Karen, including an outtake about frozen versus fresh scallops, on the Good Food blog. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also find Good Food on demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. Good Food's produced by Jillian Ferguson. Lara Garcia and Candace Moyer are our segment producers. The executive producer of Good Food is Harriet Ells. Thanks to Ronnie Mickelson and to Gary Masiha, our music man. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.